For more than 10 years, I have spent a couple of hours in conversation and reflection with men at Attica Prison, now at Sing Sing Prison, men who sometimes feel like a motherless child. This Tuesday evening is the final class for the course in Christian ethics that I'm teaching at Sing Sing Prison this semester. In respect of my students, and also because the mothers I know would rather feel their mother nature than have it lifted up on a pedestal, I am taking advantage of the spirit of this day to turn our well-wishing toward the ends for which our hearts are shaped, toward compassion for every mother's son who is in prison, and most particularly for black and brown men in prison. The men that I meet are black, black, black Latino, black white, black Latino. I would like you to see them, to feel their condition, if you do not know prison from the inside, for they are everyone a mother's son. And some of you are no doubt their mothers and their grandmothers, their sisters, their brothers, their sons, their daughters. I say this not because you've told me the story, you've had no need to. I say this because 1 in 14 black men are in prison. Between the ages of 20 and 35, 1 in 9 American black men is held in prison. 1/3 of American black men are under the control of courts, prisons, and parole boards. These men are every mother's son, but America is pitiless. For the most part, America's churches make it unsafe to talk about this. You know, it reminds me of that awful storm in New Orleans 5 years ago when everybody in the waters was black, and then black, and black again, and yet somehow America could not acknowledge that that disaster was a disaster of almost edgeless racial indifference leading up through decades to those awful days. This is the story of how America continues to drown its poorest black and brown men and women in poverty, violence, and sorrow. So far, it is a tragedy. It has no comedy on the horizon yet. Maybe we'll change that. But this is the kind of story that, apart from those who know it at first hand, usually only a mother knows, all the way down. I could wash this whole hour in facts and figures that hurt to hear. I'm going to do it some more. Between 1985 and 2005, the numbers of black men sent to prison annually in Illinois jumped 2,000%. In Chicago, 80% of all adult black males of working age have felony records. In 1999, 992 black men graduated from all the colleges of Illinois. 7,000 were released from prison in that same year into a hell of legal discrimination and social exile where their debt to society is never paid, never paid, never paid. He may be free, but many states will never allow a once convicted man to vote again, ever. More African Americans are under correctional control today than were under slavery in 1850. More are legally disenfranchised by this means I just mentioned. More are legally disenfranchised today than were in 1872. At the time of the passage of the 15th Amendment, making it illegal to bar African Americans from voting. Now you may think, You may think because politicians and televisions have been working hard to make you think this, that these awesome numbers, these painful stories issue from the violence and decay in the ghettos of American cities. If you are whitewashed with this story, you assume that prisoners of color have only been reaping the rewards of their criminal behavior. And isn't that race neutral? But a far more insidious injustice is at work than appears. In her just published book, some of you may have seen the interview with Michelle Alexander offered by Bill Moyers in one of the last of his several interviews. Alas, his work is no longer to be unfolding for America on the public channels. He's retired. But Michelle Alexander, author and law professor, published a book called The New Jim Crow in the last month. And in it, she unravels the cords that bind this nation in profound injustice. Here, I cannot attempt to back up each of her points as one might in a lecture, and as her book most surely does. For a sermon has a different purpose from a lecture. So I am asking you first to open your ear and your heart together and listen to these ideas. If some boggle your mind and you resist, read the book first, and then let's talk. Let's all talk. That's how, in fact, we'll come to a good news ending to this dark tale. The mass incarceration of blacks in America is a system of racialized control. It is, in Alexander's word, a racial caste system caused not by unusual amounts of crime among blacks, but by policies and practices of the branches of government, all three, executive, legislative, and judicial, driven by ambition, fear, and greed. When Ronald Reagan declared a war on drugs in 1982, 2% of Americans believed that illegal drug use was the most significant problem in this nation. Drug use was on the decline at the beginning of that war. But at the end of Reagan's term, 7 years later, not 2%, but 64% of Americans had been whitewashed into thinking that drug use was the worst problem America faced, even though during that time the incidence of illegal drug use is demonstrably shown not to have changed much at all. More important, the frequency of illegal drug use did not differ substantially between any of the major color groups of our country, white, Latino, black. It's always been 6% to 7%. It doesn't budge much. And yet, in many states, 90% of those sent to prison for drug offenses are black or Latino. What is happening? From the outset, I'm quoting Alexander, the war on drugs had little to do with public concern about drugs and much to do with public concern about race. Alexander demonstrates that in the aftermath of the civil rights advancements of the 1960s, the resentment that poor whites felt that blacks were no longer legally and officially inferior to them found an expression in electoral politics. As early as Nixon's campaign, the so-called Southern strategy welded the black face and the word crime together, and it was practiced for 40 years in national races of many kinds. Along with that welding of black and crime, there came promises to deal harshly with crime. This one power for legislators, for presidents, even, it seems, for justices of the Supreme Court. For 40 years, America's presidents, including Bill Clinton, could only gain their seat by supporting and developing policies that sweep millions of black and brown men into prison. Sweep is the right word. Sweep, sweep, sweep. Did you know that Reagan's war on drugs meant that the federal government directly pays police departments a bounty for every man imprisoned? Did you know that local municipalities are free by federal law to keep whatever money and property was once owned by the men they put in prison if it was involved in drugs? Did you know that throughout the last 20 years, the Supreme Court has removed all Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable search and seizure if the issue is a drug search? They're gone. In function and in character, the American policy of mass incarceration of blacks is a direct descendant of Jim Crow. Alexander puts it this way. Hundreds of years ago, our nation put those considered less than human in shackles. Less than 100 years ago, we relegated them to the other side of town. Today, we put them in cages. Since 1985, the American prison population has grown, here goes, from 350,000 to 2.3 million. 25 years. We are afflicted by a hideous blindness, a racial caste system that has devoured millions of lives, impoverished public coffers, and deranged our national purpose. Jesus tells it like it is. Think back to that story we just heard. That unshackled man with demons bruising himself on the outskirts of town, hitting himself with stones. If ever there was a motherless child, that is he. Compassion finally meets him in Jesus, the Hebrew word that lies deep in the root of the Hebrew Bible for compassion. Is the word womb. There's no fancy noun for it. It just would be Jesus felt womb. There must be a womb somewhere. But notice this in the story. Whether for the man's safety or for their own, the townspeople say that they have restrained that man with shackles and chains, but he has broken them in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him, the story says. Unless he's the Incredible Hulk, or Mark has gone silly with that amazement, something else has to be going on here. It fits reality better to propose that the town is not serious about restraining him, whether for his or their safety. Surely shackles of some size could settle anyone, unless, of course, we're talking about a cartoon. So deep down, these people don't really want to subdue him. They want him out there at the edge of town, hurting himself, going crazy. They need him there. We've seen this before. It is the basic tragedy of societies that in order to keep peace in bounds, the people put their sense of evil out there on someone else. It's called the evil empire, if you're Ronald Reagan. It's called the axis of evil, if you're George Bush. The people hold themselves completely innocent, ignorant of responsibility for evil in the world, and often they actually destroy the demonized other out at the edge of town, in torment, in exile. Here's another odd fact of the prison population. Between the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the fall of the Twin Towers in 2001, you could say between the fall of the communists and the dawn of the terrorists, America threw way more than 1 million black men in prison? Will we ever have done making someone a demon? Criminals, Alexander writes, are the one social group in America we have permission to hate. When Jesus sends demons from that man's mind into swine and the man is healed, you might think that the town, maybe not the pig farmer, but the town, would be glad that their citizen is healed. They are not. They are afraid. They beg Jesus to get out of town. You know, with no more evil man on their outskirts, that town is dangerously out of balance. They must now own their own evil or force their politicians to start shackling men in prisons and making laws to sweep a legion of hated citizens out of sight where they can be safely despised. But Jesus has healed the man. Now the man wants to follow Jesus. He is really whole. And what does Jesus say? Uh-uh, you're not following me. Usually he says, come and follow me. Not to this man. To him he says, go home to your friends. What has the master in mind? The womb of compassion knows that healing, which is only personal, is not nearly big enough to fulfill God's will. Healing must be social and communal as well as personal. That demonized man must come home free and welcome. The community must deal with its own dark side, to borrow the phrase from Jung, that it must become aware of its own greed, its own violence, its own oppression and fear, and accepting the hated one is necessary. Go home. For the man coming home from prison, it's an unrelenting terror. I have seen in a dear friend in Buffalo, New York, how inhumanly alert he had to be. A parolee must be in order to avoid all the threats that will send him back to jail like that. It is mind-bogglingly difficult. It is impossible, in fact, for most. In 2000, as many people were returned to prison for parole violations as had been put in prison for all purposes together in 1985. 1980 is the date. We are drowning in the sea of our own wrongdoing. And it is mostly carried by racial indifference, by this fiction that we should be a colorblind nation. You hear it coming more and more from the right. It's a terrible, terrible distortion. No, we need to be colorful and color aware and aware of racial caste system. The kinds of laws which the men have broken, and women, earn very short sentences in every other developed nation of the world except ours. Here, the same weight of a drug that is popular among blacks has carried until recently a sentence 100 times longer than that same weight of drug held by a white man. And the statistics show whites are simply not being dragged in by the police into this dragnet. They're not under the broom. It is an entirely racist process. If you doubt it, read the book. You will weep like a mother whose son has been taken hostage by unruly, violent men bound to kill him. So we must come to an end. What is the gospel message here? When I was 20 or so, the only homosexuals I had any encounter with were men cruising in cars, offering me money for their pleasure as I walked home. I was disgusted and angry at the whole thing. I knew of no other option. As that decade passed, fortunately, gay men, gay women too, were able to show a wholly different side of reality coming out of the closet in couples, in happiness and pride. Within that decade, my whole view changed completely. And to be really simple about it, it had to do with connections, with knowing who was on the other side of the label. But where do you meet men out of prison? Not in church. Oh, yes, at Gethsemane. The entire church is composed of formerly incarcerated men and a few who go besides. They made these beautiful flowers. And that's great that they have a church to go to, but where are the formerly incarcerated millions? They're not in the churches. It's not safe to be in churches yet. Haven't you heard that about another group or two or three? Why are they not here? This is a conversation where the gospel begins to come alive. Jesus says to the man who had demons, go home. We need to find ways to welcome men who have been in prison to come home to us. It's essential. And Christian churches, at least theoretically, are better situated than any other part of the American world to find an open heart, a mother's heart, an open ear, to begin to find ways to make it certain that a man or woman who has been in prison can come home. 40 years ago, Martin Luther King, just before he was murdered, called on this whole nation to undergo a complete restructuring of its heart. Every year, every month, the Dalai Lama is calling upon the world. He uses the phrase again and again to notice that we have known compassion from our mother's arms. It is available to come alive and see every mother's son in everyone who lives. Friends, may we seek that day when Happy Mother's Day is a happier day for every mother's son. Let us bring this alive as a conversation about race here at First Church. Amen.